In today's episode of Global Health TV, we'll be hearing from activist, academic, and feminist Loretta Ross. Loretta Ross was one of the African-American women who first coined the term reproductive justice. Her activism began when she was tear-gassed at a demonstration as a first-year student at Howard University in 1970. With a 50-year history of advocacy, Ross has been a leader of many programs, marches, and centers that focus on enhancing justice for all. My colleague Autry Godfrey caught up with Professor Ross at the 150th American Public Health Association annual meeting in Boston, Massachusetts.
After the Supreme Court voted to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, the resulting reproductive freedom landscape became very complex. Here in studio with us to navigate what this historic decision means about the future of being female and reproductive health is activist and advocate Loretta Ross. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get started with defining what is reproductive justice.
Well, reproductive justice was a concept 12 black women created in Chicago in June of 1994, because we were impatient with the pro-choice, pro-life binary that failed to adequately express what we needed from reproductive politics. So basically, we joined with the pro-choice movement in fighting for the right not to have a child. And so that includes support for abortion, birth control, and abstinence, if you can hold on, I mean. Abstinence, right? Anyway, but because we were black women, always subjected to thinking that we have too many babies, we have to fight for the right to have the children that we want to have and the conditions under which we want to have them. So that means refusing an unnecessary C-section or having your birth plan respected when you go to the hospital or using a midwife or a doula if you prefer. And then the third tenet is the right to raise our children in safe and healthy environments, because neither the pro-choice nor the pro-life movement focuses on what happens when the baby is here. And so the right to have a child, not to have a child, and to raise your children are the three core tenets of reproductive justice.
So really, reproductive justice is just being able to say, have a say in all aspects of your body.
But it's not divorced from the context in which those decisions are made. Because if a person doesn't have housing security or a bedroom to put a child in, or if they're afraid that they'll lose their job if they continue a pregnancy, or that their partner will beat them if they tell them they're pregnant, all of these are human rights issues that need to be considered because they affect reproductive decision making. And so that's why reproductive justice is based on the international human rights framework, because we need to have housing security, food security, school safety, job security, all of those other issues in order to plan our families and raise them in safe and healthy ways, which of course includes paying attention to the environment as well.
And are those certain things that you just listed off, all those different aspects, are those things that you feel like the mainstream reproductive movement has failed to pay attention to?
Well, I don't think that they've given them sufficient attention, but I never try to blame the victims from the crimes of the perpetrators. I mean, we're up against a well-funded anti-woman agenda, anti-gay agenda, anti-immigrant agenda, anti-freedom agenda. And so I don't like blaming the pro-choice movement for the crimes of the opposition, when in fact, if they had any sense at all, instead of trying to coerce women into having more babies, and I'm specifically saying white women because I'm not convinced that they want more brown and black babies, but if they wanted to coerce women into having babies, they'd do better by incentivizing them. But by providing childcare, health care, you know, protected medical leave, paid medical leave to raise a family, paying for infertility treatments for women who want to have children. But they're not that smart, because that would be too much like supporting a feminist agenda.
That would so make too much sense.
Right, so they're going to do through coercion, which incentives might actually better achieve.
Do you think that slowly but surely there is starting to be a better understanding of how black women's reproductive lives in particular are over-policed?
Yes. Ever since Dorothy Roberts wrote that path-breaking book, Killing the Black Body, we've had a theoretical framework to understand how, up until the end of slavery, our fertility was treasured because it was a wealth-producing strategy. And then after 1865, that same fertility was criminalized and the bodies that carried those babies were criminalized. So apparently we were good enough to raise white babies but not black ones kind of thing. And that continues to be the narrative, that somehow our children are responsible for crime, for environmental degradation. I mean, even they blamed us for the mortgage crisis. Like, we live on Wall Street and make those kinds of decisions. And so we see the criminalization of pregnancy behaviors. You know, if they don't strictly follow somebody else's idea of what a good pregnancy is, and they're ending up incarcerated for that. Doctors are refusing to do necessary medical interventions for fear of being attacked by anti-abortion zealots if they save a woman's life who has cancer or whatever. And they're particularly vulnerable if they're black and African American, because we anticipate that there's gonna be a 39% rise in maternal mortality because of the wave of abortion restrictions after the Dobbs decision. So we're going to see real suffering in the black community, but I still wanna emphasize that we're just the sideshow, because it's not about increasing black fertility or black babies. It really is about forced breeding for white women, because that's the population they often let slip that they really prioritize. Like Steve King said, we can't save civilization with somebody else's babies kind of thing. And so they once in a while let the truth out, and it is about managing the fertility of white women, pushing them out of the job market because there's too few jobs to go around, and restricting their educational opportunities so that they don't get the education and have the knowledge necessary.
Right. To be able to provide.
To be able to provide, but also to make their own independent reproductive decisions. So they're convincing them that, you know, having a healthy sexuality is a sin. Choosing when and where you have a child is a sin. I mean, all of those kinds of things. And unfortunately, too many people are vulnerable to that kind of emotional manipulation.
All right, let's pivot a little bit and talk about what is reproductive futurism.
Well, reproductive futurism is a concept I've been thinking about. I didn't coin the term reproductive futurism. That actually was coined by the LGBTQ movement. But I'm applying it to use the lens of reproductive justice to really criticize, or at least examine, this techno-utopia that all the people who are promoting all of these unfounded promises of what technical advancements are going to do to the human species, they really need to be examined. Because first of all of our technology, like social media, may be used to upgrade present day inequalities, because we have not addressed the underlying causes of misogyny and racism and homophobia and transphobia. And so we'll just have better means of implementing the same old ideas if we don't pay attention. But also, techno-utopia overpromises. They convince women, for example, to pay $20,000 for an IVF treatment without telling them that only 13% of stored eggs ever result in successful pregnancies. So you've got an 87% failure rate for something you just spent $20,000 a try on. And many people have to try multiple times, because it's not just one time, you gotta do it multiple times. And they're not telling people the medical risk of egg harvesting and
the cancer concerns
down
the road.
They're not telling. There's no full medical disclosure required of them, so they're not doing it. And so I am concerned that unrestricted reproductive technology that doesn't have moral boundaries or guidelines will end up exploiting vulnerable and desperate people who want to express their right to parent in the way that they want to and can be easily manipulated and suffer mental health damages because of it, because they've just spent a lot of money, often going into debt to try to achieve that wanted child. And at the same time, they're frustrated because it doesn't happen. They have cradle envy for the people who do have babies. And let's be clear, the right to parent can be expressed in many other ways than genetically. I mean, we've got so many children waiting to be adopted in foster care that need a loving family. So there's kind of like a patriarchal thing going on, because what's so precious about your DNA is never asked when you actually can successfully parent and contribute to human improvement by taking care of the children already here who desperately want a loving family.
Let's pivot a little bit and talk about you personally. You've got a long history in the fight for reproductive freedom, among other social injustices. I just wondered if there was maybe a moment in your life where you thought, okay, this is it. This is, this is going to be my fight. Advocacy is my calling.
There was a moment, but it's not a happy story. When I was 27 years old, a dear friend of mine was assassinated for doing her political work on housing gentrification in Washington, D.C. Her name was Yolanda Ward. And even though I'd been doing political work for over a decade at that time, I didn't think it was going to be my life calling. As a matter of fact, I majored in chemistry and physics.
Oh,
I was a STEM girl.
Okay.
Heading a totally different direction.
You were.
But Yolanda's death caused a lot of us who were doing anti-apartheid work or prison abolition work or anti-gentrification work to really reassess whether or not we were going to stay on the front lines, because it scared us.
Yeah.
And so I had to make the very intentional decision whether or not I was going to be exposed to those risks. And I did, and I'm glad I did, but it wasn't an accident. Up until then, I'd been an accidental activist.
Okay.
Then I was an intentional one. And then I had another moment in 1995 with the bombing of the Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City. And at that time, I was doing anti-Klan work, fighting the KKK, militias, patriot movement, militia movement, all of that. And I was okay doing that work. We got a lot of visibility because we had predicted that it was a white supremacist and not a Muslim terrorist, like the media was saying at the time. But all of that came to be in question when the Texas militia found my parents' unlisted phone number and invited them to a militia meeting so that they could prove to their daughter that they weren't a racist hate group. And my poor little innocent mother was so busy bragging on her daughter, she didn't recognize the threat implied in that invitation. And so I had to get on the phone, talk to Dad, who was a weapons specialist and a retired Army vet. And Dad populated the yard with Smith & Wesson signs everywhere to let him know that you don't come messing with us, because he was a member of the National Rifle Association. He was a weapons specialist.
Okay.
But then I had to question whether I had the right to expose my family
to those dangers,
to the choices that I had made. And so I had to have a conversation with my family to get their support in continuing to do the work, because the same way abortion providers have to do today with their families. So those were the two moments when I had to really question, not my commitment to the work, but was I willing to take the risk? Because probably about 3 years before then, my picture had appeared in a Klan newspaper, but that didn't bother me so much as that veiled threat to my parents.
Wow. That's interesting. I mean, you've mentioned several different historic, moments that you've lived through, the Oklahoma City bombing, your colleague being assassinated. When you think back of all of the different, large moments in history that you've witnessed, where would you put the overturning of Roe v. Wade on that scale? Is it something that's just as important?
Well, it's just as important, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But let's be clear, I'm a Black woman who comes from a community that has been so frequently disappointed by the Supreme Court.
You're not surprised.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because the judicial system has never been a guarantor of black liberation. I mean, we've had Dred Scott, Plessy v. Ferguson, Shelby v. Holder, Citizens United. I mean, we could just list all of the Supreme Court decisions that have gone against freedom and liberation as far as black people. And so we never reposited into the Supreme Court a lot of confidence that they were going to protect our rights, and particularly those of us in the women's movement have been like Cassandra saying for 50 years that the right to privacy is not in the Constitution, and what the Supreme Court can give it, the Supreme Court can take it away. And then watching the ruthlessness with which Mitch McConnell orchestrated the packing of the Supreme Court by refusing Merrick Garland a seat on it, and then rushing through Amy Coney Barrett when it was convenient for him and all of that, we knew that the writing was on the wall. And so we have to do what we always do, which is center the most vulnerable women in the lens and the people capable of being pregnant, because they're the ones that are going to suffer the most. So we're going to use both legal and extra legal means to protect women, whether it's smuggling in the abortion pills to those states where people don't have access, or using an underground railroad to transport the people out of those states. By the way, what the opponents to abortion have forgotten is a couple of things. First of all, thousands of us know how to provide abortions now. This is not 1973. Right. You cannot unlearn the knowledge you have about how to perform abortions, and we have no intention of doing so. Matter of fact, we're training even more people in the technology and the access. But the other thing that they significantly forgot was their own base, the pro-choice Republican women who led the defeat in Kansas. You know, there aren't enough Democratic votes in Kansas to have decided that victory to protect abortion rights in the Kansas Constitution. It was pro-choice Republican women. And so the way I look at this upcoming election is probably a little different than a lot of doomsayers, because I'm saying, wait a moment. These men are dealing with a revolution not in the black community, because they know how we're gonna go. They're dealing with a revolution at their own dinner tables. They're pissing off their own women, and we've got their kids.
Their wives are mad.
Right, and their children are mad, you know, because yeah. Their kids are far more intersectional, far more woke than they want them to be. I mean, in the 2020 election, 56% of white kids, youth voters from 18 to 29, voted for Biden. They were the only white demographic that didn't break in a majority for Trump. And so we got their kids with our cool, with our music, and now we got them at the ballot box. And that's what they're afraid of. And so there's a lot of voter suppression happening around college campuses, predominantly white institutions, trying to prevent young white kids from voting too.
You're referencing the next generation and the up and coming generation. You know, there are a lot of younger folks here at APHA, and you have talked about having a toolkit that could be useful for the younger public health advocates. What should people put in that toolkit? What would you say to the younger generation when it comes to activism and advocacy?
Well, the thing that I do best is channel the wisdom of my ancestors. Because long ago, I was cautioned against taking myself too seriously, that the cause is perfect and I don't have to be. Mm-hmm. And so one of the sayings in the civil rights movement is that don't imagine that you're the entire chain of freedom, because the chain of freedom stretches back towards your ancestors and stretches forward towards your descendants. So the only thing you really need to worry about is that the chain of freedom doesn't break at your link.
I love that.
That's the only thing you need to worry about.
Yeah.
So don't give in to despair or hopelessness. Fight the good fight, but also give up the expectation that the timeline is yours to command.
I love that thought process. That is wonderful. Okay, last question for you here. We've been talking a lot about, obviously, reproductive rights here in the United States. Do you think, though, because a lot of people watch what the United States does, you know, a lot of other countries, do you think that reproductive rights, abortion rights, reproductive justice is under threat globally?
Well, I've done a lot of work recently with the United Nations Fund for Population, And what I've seen by working with them is that there are too many countries that are assaulting women's reproductive rights, and they're, and the activists in those countries are using in very effective ways the reproductive justice framework to create the political space that they didn't have solely focusing on abortion rights. And yet there are many countries who many leaders of many countries who know that their countries need bodies for their labor force, for their economy, for their military. And so they're trying to put barriers in the way of women controlling their fertility because they want the fodder for those things. And so we are seeing a global assault on women's self-determination, but at the same time, we're seeing some amazing victories in Latin America and other countries where people are going against, you know, the intransigence of the church and the state and fighting for their reproductive freedom and self-determination. So it's a mixed bag, but in many different ways, authoritarianism has re-risen and is really attacking women's human rights.
Right. Loretta, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you for interviewing me.
Next time in the Global Health Clinic, we'll be discussing law, ethics, and global health with Larry Gostin and Paul Reed, director of the U.S. Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, discusses health equity and the social determinants of health.